Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Now, as you can see, there's a slightly different title. I will come to the time question at the very end of this talk. But I was thinking yesterday when Albert spoke, what might actually be very useful for this group, for our discussion. And I just learned that we have a discussion session where we will all sit in the hot seat. That is all the speakers of today, and you can ask us any questions. I will speak about method, and I should give my 2 cents on that, where I'm coming from, so you understand better why I talk the way I talk, and why I ask the questions I ask, and why I want us to think about this passage in the physics in the way that we hopefully will talk about it towards the end or the last third of this session. Okay, so then I will start by talking a little bit about method. I will walk you through the talk. If there's anything that is unclear, please raise your hand very highly so this head in front here can see, because it's not a real body standing here. But anyway, please raise your hand with regards to comprehension question during this session. We will have a discussion at the very end. And if I fail to do good timekeeping, Father Philip Neri will remind me that I ought to do so. All right, let's start. As modern historians of medieval philosophy and science, we enjoy a remarkable array of scholarly tools. We can trace debates with forensic precision, follow manuscripts across centuries, and situate texts within richly detailed cultural networks. Yet might these very strengths prompt us to ask new questions about our own role as historians of philosophy within the modern university? How in this context can we recover not only what Albert the Great taught, but also why he taught? His vision of forming human beings whose senses, imagination, and intellect and will converge in the pursuit of truth. What if the title that was given to him much after he lived, Doctor Universalis, points us beyond an encyclopedism toward a living realization of our human nature through scientia? Could our historiographies honor the formative claims embedded in that title? This talk offers a proposal according to which to write universally about the Doctor Universalis means neither to abstract him from the 13th century, nor to elevate him into an atemporal oracle. It means letting his self-described task, the habitus of scientia, that culminates in homo solus intellectus, interrogate our own historiographical habits. Albert staged philosophy, and I'll speak about theology in 1 minute, but I'm going to talk about philosophy today, to core. So Albert staged philosophy as a four-tiered path of becoming human through scientia. Logic disciplines discursive clarity, physics inducts the mind into causal intelligibility, mathematics entrains the imagination to necessity, and metaphysics stabilizes all knowledge in being as such, and all being as such in the first cause. Now, practical philosophy lies beyond the scope of my talk. It naturally crowns the sequence and accompanies it. And Tracy could say much, much more about this anyway. The itinerary in its concrete formulation may be considered by some as a medieval curiosity, but here I wish to think about it as a reminder that knowing, and especially scientific knowing, is always also a mode of human self-constitution. Regardless in which particular shape it arises, a science, in fact, any science that forgets this dimension forfeits its most humane promise. The emergence of a knower who grasps both the power and ethical limits of its insight. So to recover that promise within us, and thus to write universally about the Doctor Universalis from an anthropological perspective, I proceed first by portraying systematically four prevailing images of knowledge that shape present-day scholarship. Contemporary historiography approaches Albert chiefly through what I call the combat image, a drama of scholastic contest in which arguments win or lose. The transmission image, a logistics of ideas moving through scribes, classrooms, and libraries. The contextualizing image, a thick description of Albert's embeddedness in 13th century mentalité. And the systematic image, a division of his works into branches of knowledge, understood primarily as compartmentalized specialists. Each image of knowledge has yielded indispensable results, not least because together they compose our modern toolkit, or mirror our modes of working at modern research institutions, yet each precisely by foregrounding struggle, diffusion, context, or system, tends to marginalize Albert's central claim that scientia is a transformative habitus of the human being who pursues it. My first task is thus to revisit our field through the lens of these four images of knowledge, asking whether where they illuminate and where they occlude the formative thrust of Albert's project. I should say that I'm only going to speak about philosophy here because the habit of theology is a distinct habit for Albert, which comes with very distinct authorities. Albert showed parts of this passage that you see on the slide yesterday, but I should say here that whenever he invokes Augustine as a towering authority, it's when he talks theologically on the basis of the habit of theology or the light of faith. And he believes the philosophers, Aristotle and the other experts, he says, when it comes to natural philosophy, so philosophia realis, which also includes mathematics and metaphysics, and when it comes to medicine, of course, and Galen and Hippocrates are his authorities. Interestingly enough, Avicenna is missing on the medical side with his canon, which is what Albert really does in his De Animalibus, or uses. Now, perhaps we should talk a little bit about the table of content that I gave you, the first reading, from Albert's De Hominem. What you can see on page, let me just see, 7 there, where he begins to speak about the his motivis quae antecedunt istas, that's where Albert breaks from a purely peripatetic consideration of the human soul or of man into a more theological consideration, where he changes of authorities. Now, his De Homina, and this is a very important point, predates the commentary on the sentences with this quotation. The sentences, in fact, book 2 of the sentences, is where Albert works out a clear methodological distinction between the science of theology and the science of philosophy. He did not have this before. That's why I gave you the De Homina, because that's where he's still grappling with it, where he's still trying to work it out. And everything that you find in the De Homina is what I consider, and this goes against some of the literature that's been written about the De Homina, a kind of descriptive grappling that he does with these new peripatetic sources and thinking, active thinking about how to integrate the two of them into a scientific order. Not system, but order. And here in this passage, also from the sentences of one very famous, now relatively freshly edited by Maria Burga, we can see that it's very clear that theology has a different goal in mind, and therefore also a different subject matter. For instance, he says here, Nunc autem accipit eas potet usum genium eis qui ad vertitudinem progreditur. So theology is the kind of science that has a teleological structure towards beatitude, whereas considering things in the world just in and of themselves belongs to philosophia realis. What I'm going to present today to you is also a way of thinking about how these two might come together in an anthropology. Because once we turn away from methodological structure and think about what the impact is on the human being, we find that both theology and philosophy actually make full sense in the full development of the human being. Okay, so those are introductory remarks. Building on this diagnostic of the four images of knowledge that I just alluded to, in the second section of my talk today, I will highlight some passages in which Albert unequivocally conceives of philosophy as an ordered practice of human becoming. It's not a system, it's not a kind of specialisms that you have to walk your way through, but it's a practice of human becoming. Here I trace how the logical, physical, mathematical, and metaphysical parts of his rational and real philosophy jointly cultivate the human intellect as a whole, leading not simply to more information, but to a qualitative shift in the knower. The passage from discursive reason to the acquired intellect that makes, as he says, the human in a way like God. And I will qualify this remark later on. So in that section, I intend to show that for Albert, science is enabling, before it's encyclopedic, the latter of which is a mere accident of his aim for ascent. And then in the last part, we will have a discussion on how this passage on time and his use of Augustine there fits into this larger picture. Okay, when we write the history of medieval philosophy, we rarely say how we engage with the knowledge we are, in fact, writing about. Drawing on a distinction made by the Israeli historian of science, Yehuda Elkana, I want to ask how Albert the Great has been framed by four of our own dominant images that have guided modern research since the late 19th century methodological revolutions. From Rankean source criticism through social, structural, and contextual analyses to the post-linguistic turn fascination with discourse. Yehuda, in his paper, A Programmatic Attempt at an Anthropology of Knowledge, distinguished between what he called the body of knowledge, the explicit contents that we engage with, which in our case would be anything that Albert says in his opus, and the so-called images of knowledge, the quote, socially determined views on knowledge that determine for each culture, society, group, or community the following issues. One, sources of knowledge. Two, legitimization of knowledge. Three, audience or public of knowledge. Four, location of the sacred secular continuum. Five, location of some of the aspects of its time scale continuum. Six, degrees of consciousness. Seven, relatedness to prevailing norms, values. And eight, translatability into statements about nature, unquote. Seen systematically, not chronologically, this conception of images of knowledge can be applied to Albert, and I would like to classify them into four: the combat, mechanistic, historicizing, and systematic conceptions of his scientia. Each has generated invaluable scholarship, each, however, tends to eclipse what Albert himself regarded as central, the acquisition of scientia as a habitus, a formative path that culminates in homo solo intellectus. Okay, let's look at them. Scholars of the early 20th century cast the Parisian schools as an intellectual agon. Albert appears here as a gladiator contending with Greek and Arabic peripatetics, Augustinians, and his Dominican pupil Thomas Aquinas. Now, all these quotations that you see, they are examples from the companion on Albert the Great that was published by Resnick edited and published by Resnick in 2013. In more recent decades, the image has been refined by close dossier studies. Disputation analyses map Albert's dialectical modus agendi, replacing heroic generalities of the beginning of modern Albert scholarship with thematic reconstructions of individual questions. The combat model excels at revealing Albert's extraordinary synthetic agility. He rarely discards an opponent's insight if he can re-inscribe it within a more universal definition or demonstration. We also gain a precise chronology of Persian teaching cycles and a sharper sense of how public disputation calibrated reputations and curricula. Yet, a Darwinian-like fascination with winners and losers risks obscuring Albert's formative intention. His dialectic was never an end in itself. It was a gymnasium for forming students' habits of judgment, judicatio. Focusing on which argument prevailed leaves unanswered the deeper question, what kind of person does persistent disputation enable the knower to become? That formative telos, the transition from ratio to intellectus, largely vanishes if we only concentrate on the clash of authorities. The mechanistic image of knowledge, parallel to trends, to these trends, a second strand, Albert treats, the scholarship treats Albert as a node in networks of textual transmission. The critical Editio Coloniensis catalogs every Aristotelian Arabic and Hebraic layer of a given lemma. Ansulevich's recent overview highlights the editorial infrastructure that underpins this work. But other scholars, like, for instance, my PhD student Fabio De Gregorio, trace how Albert was vernacularized and recopied in biblical Hebrew commentaries. So you have Albert's sources, like the Arabs, Augustine, go into Albert and make their way out of Albert again into other thinkers. By the way, the conception of time that stands behind this is very modern and very interesting compared to the conception that Albert has on time. We can speak more about this. This mechanistic image illuminates the logistics of medieval learning. Which codices did Albert own? Which glosses did he exert? This painstaking work secures our primary texts and explains the vehicles of influence with a precision earlier generations would have dreamt of. But logistics can also eclipse teleology. When Albert becomes a conduit for Aristotelian physics or Dionysian mysticism, his urgent claim that scientia must reorder the knower toward virtue and beatitude fades. What got transmitted is cataloged, why it ought to be desired and interiorized, even by us today, is seldom asked in this kind of image of knowledge. Another image of knowledge embeds Albert within the mentalité of the High Middle Ages. This is something that you find, for instance, in the history of science, but also in the work of Ludger Honnefelder, for instance, where he talks about the ideal of education. At the local theology faculties of Paris, but also in Cologne and Regensburg, the curricula statutes, the preaching expectations, and the piety that informs Albert's theological works. These studies show how Albert echoes, for instance, Franciscan concerns in the De Animalibus, how he absorbs, scripture, how he negotiates imperial politics, even in a Super Ethica. Albert's texts thus become cultural artifacts whose meanings shift with audience and performative context. Such contextualization rescues Albert from any anachronisms and helps modern readers to avoid projecting later categories back onto the 13th century master, an occurrence which has taken place all too often in the literature. But it also opens a fruitful dialogue with social historians and manuscript curators, among others. But this radical contextualism can seal Albert off as a curiosity, a relic to their world, but not to ours. If his categories are only 13th century, then the formal structure of ciencia as a habituating ascent and its relevance to current human self-understanding remains invisible. And the last one. A fourth picture emerged from 19th and 20th century schemes of classification of the different disciplines at universities. Here, Albert's works are slotted into modern disciplinary boxes, logic, physics, metaphysics, ethics, and then edited into modern textual critical standards. Now, this is a horizontal arrangement of the meanings of his works, you know, how they're structured systematically. But taxonomy like this can freeze what Albert considered a living system, if you want to call it like this. Once Albert is packaged into modern academic divisions, the sequential enabling character of his curriculum looks like compartmentalized specialisms rather than stages or parts in the genesis of a unified intellectus. Disciplinary neatness thereby undercuts the holistic formation as Albert designed it. In sum, these four images highlight combat, circulation, context, and classification. But there's a fifth one, integrative anthropology, which calls us back to Albert's own telos. The formation of the scientific subject whose perfected intellect, the intellectus adeptus, mirrors divine simplicity to the extent that it's humanly possible through philosophy. Henrik Anzulewicz names this the hermeneutic order that binds Albert's entire corpus into a circle of exitus, perfectio, reditus, or reductio, actually. So we don't have just the two moments of exitus and reditus, but we have three moments in Albert. Exitus, perfectio, reductio. To take that order of an anthropological enablement seriously is not to discard the gains of modern Albert scholarship, but to reinscribe all these scholarly endeavors within the universal question that Albert bequeaths to us. How does knowing transform the knower? Okay, so let's look at his anthropology of philosophical ciencia. And I will just focus now on the beginning of the commentary on the physics, so we can then talk about the time passage. It's a striking paradox of our age that the discipline of philosophy, now more than ever at the modern research university, prides itself on rigor in almost every scientific way, disciplinary boundaries, and the relentless acquisition of new information. The modern university is organized on the principle that value lies in novelty, the uncovering of some heretofore unnoticed historical or theoretical terrain, or the answering of tightly circumscribed research questions. The philosopher, we, in this model, become a technician of consequence, tasked with clarifying terms, solving puzzles, and contributing a paper to an ever-growing archive of partial answers. The subject of the philosopher, if it exists at all, is thus atomized and uprooted, so at least it feels to me, an individual intellect engaged in a competitive accumulation and display of information, rather than a human being engaged in becoming ever more human. Albert the Great advances that vision. For him, the whole purpose of scientia is not to inform, but to form the human being in his or her becoming fully human. Not to furnish the human mind with an ever-expanding hoard of data, but to cultivate the human intellectual soul in the direction of its own actualization. Philosophical scientia, Albert insists, is never external to the human being, but the most intimate mode or way by which the subject is gradually enabled to become what it is, homo solus intellectus, as he calls it. To appreciate this alternative vision of philosophical science and its sharp contrast with the objectifying models of science of both his time and ours, I wish to take a closer look at his vision in some passages. As a general remark, we discover in Albert an integrated framework of philosophical science that regards the disciplines of rational philosophy, logic, of natural philosophy, mathematics, and metaphysics, so real philosophy, as sequential steps in this progressive formation, namely the actualization of the human intellect. Each scientia enables the next by cultivating a specific habitus, a stable disposition of the mind that gradually elevates its possessor to more universal truth. In the first text, here we find Albert speak of the work of the logician and also the mastery and conclusion of that work. This short paragraph does two crucial jobs. It classifies logic as a discipline whose subject is discourse, not reality. And this is the decisive move. It says explicitly that discursive hygiene is a condition for any other scienza. If your propositions are malformed or your chains of inference crooked, no amount of any acumen in physics or metaphysics will save you. De Universalibus, his introduction to logic, thus lays the formative foundation for everything that follows before the teacher can speak of nature or number or being. He or she must teach students how to speak about anything at all without falling into error. With the ability to reason properly honed, Albert then turns to what he calls the three parts of real philosophy. And I'm stressing parts because part here is really important. What he develops with physics, mathematics, and metaphysics is mereology, parts to a whole. And the question is, where is that whole located? This is the structure of mereology that Albert grants real philosophy. The parts, metaphysics, mathematics, and natural philosophy, form the whole real philosophy, but they do so not in an abstract way, removed from the knower. Indeed, they do so because of the human knower, more precisely because of his cognitive abilities. This might perhaps strike us as trivial, where in fact it's a deep insight into the very nature of the human being. The three parts of real philosophy form not an abstract whole, but a human or subject-centered whole. The distinguishing notes of the sciences are the degrees of abstraction in an opposite relationship to the degrees of being. By pairing each degree with the corresponding cognitive powers involved, Albert links ontology to anthropology. What makes a study mathematical is not only its object, but the fact that human beings grasp that object by imagination and intellect, whereas metaphysics asks the intellect to operate without any imaginative crutch at all. But you have to work your way up there. From now on, the listener knows that every discipline, once he knows metaphysics, every discipline in the curriculum will be defined by the precise mixture of faculties, of the faculties that it exercises. So this is important for us to keep in mind as we proceed, because immediately from this arrangement of the whole to its parts arises the question, what does the whole of real philosophy and the human cognitive apparatus amount to? Does it amount to a knowledge about reality, or does it amount to assimilation to reality? In a significant sense of this Aristotelian dictum. So we look at the next passage, which follows immediately on this one. This is the very beginning of the physics. Once you have time after the seminar, maybe just read it through, because I'm going through this very quickly now. So Albert's move here shifts from mapping the cognitive structure of the sciences to laying out their causal and epistemic hierarchy. Because the first simple quiditas being as such cascades downward, first into quantified being and then fully into sensible being, metaphysics is the source from which mathematics and physics both take existence and their first principles. Thus the so-called partes of philosophia realis are asymmetrical. Mathematics and natural philosophy presuppose axioms that can be demonstrated only in metaphysics. Albert therefore brands metaphysics the universal science, not for its encyclopedic range, but because it alone contemplates being insofar as it is being, and the insofar as is the most important point here. That is, at the level where existence itself is neither quantified nor qualified, By contrast, mathematics and physics each study a contracted slice of being, the quantifiable and the mobile qualifiable, respectively. From this causal order, Albert extracts a normative claim about the authority to question principles, since the mathematician and the natural philosopher have no independent path to prove or disprove the basic properties of being. Only the first philosopher may do so and inquire into them and even dispute them. The logician joins that first philosopher in a limited way because logic proceeds ex communibus from notions that belong to many genera, yet are not essential to any one of them. Hence, logic is dubbed inquisitiva by Albert. It can trace every method back to its starting points, but cannot ground those points in reality, the prerogative of metaphysics alone. The final paragraph of this first chapter of Albert's Physics is where he turns from the objective hierarchy of the sciences to the formative enactment by which he will deliver that hierarchy to his students. Metaphysics, he concedes, is the last in the order of what is sought and known because it reaches the deepest causes, yet it must be the first in the order of teaching if one were able to start from what's ontologically prior. Obviously, no student can do that, right? In practice, teaching, however, must follow the path of the least cognitive resistance. The intellect, by its very constitution, gathers knowledge from sense, reflecting on what the eyes and the ears first deliver. Hence, a curriculum that begins with pure being would cripple his audience. Albert therefore reverses the causal cascade he has just drawn. Because of their natural embodied setup, humans ought to begin with what is graspable by all three, sense, imagination, and intellect, which amounts to natural philosophy, then ascend towards what needs imagination and intellect, mathematics, and they can finally culminate in what demands the naked intellect, metaphysics. Let me say something here about this passage. If you read closely, Albert links sensation, imagination, and intellection to doctrina, to teaching. It's not going out into the world and having direct contacts to the objects themselves and using a kind of method of observation or experimentation. This is teaching by means of sense, imagination, and understanding. What that implies is what he lays out further in the metaphysics in the beginning chapters. But this is very important to note. The order of teaching thus respects the anthropological fact that he earlier used to define the sciences themselves, namely that every level of abstraction must be matched to the powers through which humans can engage it. Qualitative relation to the world involving sense, imagination, and intellect thus comes before quantitative relation involving imagination and intellect, and that comes before absolute relation involving intellect alone. Now, the following passage comes from Albert's Metaphysics. I could have given you something from the beginning of the Metaphysics, which is what most people look at, but I found this passage in Book 6 of the Metaphysics very interesting, because it gives a crystal clear further clarification on the order of the real sciences that will explain how physics is the most particular science, followed by mathematics and metaphysics. In this passage, Albert emphasizes that metaphysics is not merely the third science listed along physics and mathematics, but the common science that vertically encloses them both. Because its object is being qua being, whatever belongs to things as quantitative or as qualitative and mobile already falls within the wider horizon of ends and quantum ends. Metaphysics therefore relates to the lower sciences as a universal whole to its particular parts. It turns on the human cognitive ability to reduce the determinate modes of being to the very act of being that underlies every determination. Albert's scientific mereology is thus hierarchical and not coordinate. Metaphysics supplies the first principles on which the other disciplines depend and into which their findings are ultimately resolved, but this is not because of an abstract structure. This is because the human being itself requires this structure to climb them in reverse. Metaphysics, then, is the scientia stabilis for the human knower, It is not defined by its utility or instrumental function vis-a-vis the other sciences, but by its engagement with what is first, highest, and most causative. It doesn't borrow from the other sciences, but they borrow from it. It is self-caused in the sense that its principles are not derived from any other domain. It is both theoretical and doctrinal in the highest degree because it teaches not only truths, but their first grounds, and these are being as being, and the cause of being. As such, it enables the student to see the structural hierarchy of knowledge, how disciplines like physics and mathematics are ordered to and dependent upon metaphysical principles, and most importantly, how they are parts of the knowledge of metaphysics, which forms the whole, because it's the most universal science. This, Albert says, in good Aristotelian fashion, closes the circle to the human desire to know, which lies in the nature of the human being. Humans uniquely among animals delight in knowing for its own sake. But this natural desire is not fully satisfied until the intellect comes into contact with the most noble object of knowledge, the divine, simple, universal cause of all being. So, being as being is not yet sufficient, even in metaphysics, but must also be resolved into its own cause, the cause of all being. Thus, Albert weaves the ontology of metaphysics into a single ascent to its theology. So when you see Henry Gantzelewicz, for instance, write about onto theology, this is what he means. The first cause. These twin passages here crystallize Albert's conviction that metaphysics bears a subject matter, being as being, and an object to which it is directed, the first cause. Philosophical inquiry comes to its resolution in the study of being as being. It itemizes the parts and passions of ens commune, and thereby provides a conceptual resting place for every intellect seeking these first principles. But as theological inquiry, it studies being as predicated of the first cause, that immobile substance from whom all existing things flow. The same science therefore ranges from the most universal notes of existence to the contemplation of God precisely as the fountainhead of those notes. This twofoldness of metaphysics brings the vertical mereology that I have traced to its end. Metaphysics encloses mathematics and physics because ens commune encloses their restricted objects, and it simultaneously surpasses them by orienting the mind to the ultimate cause of being. In formative terms, the student first masters being's common structure, and only then turns that vision upward to the divine source. Thus, the ascent from sensible quality, starting in physics, to quantity, to pure being, culminates not in an abstraction that is completely emptied of content, but in a gaze upon the very cause that bestows being, fulfilling the intellect's natural desire to know and completing the itinerary in the intellectus adeptus. The highest enabling act of metaphysics is thus as much anthropological as it is ontological and theological. It perfects the human being as human by virtue of knowing the ultimate cause. When the intellect, formed by logic, cognizant of nature and disciplined by mathematics, finally beholds being as such and the cause of being, and understands all other things in light of being in God, it becomes, as Albert says, divine-like. This outcome is not just more knowledge in an objective sense, possessed by a community to solve its imminent life-related challenges, but a transformed and completely reordered knower, reordered within the order of the universe. The cumulative disciplining in logic, natural philosophy, mathematics, and metaphysics thus brings about the perfection of the rational human soul, a soul that, in the act of metaphysical contemplation, becomes solus intellectus. And by virtue of being that intellectus, he or she has the power to properly teach and act in the world. This culminating insight that knowledge shapes the very substance of the knower, who in turn reshapes the humans and the world around him, offers a salutary counterpoint to any formative model that prizes information above formation.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.